Welcome to today's deep dive. We are really thrilled you're here with us. If you've been paying any attention to the world of artificial intelligence recently, you already know things are moving at a staggering pace.
Oh, absolutely. Almost terrifyingly fast, depending on the day.
Right. And sitting right at the center of all this rapid advancement is this profound, looming question: who is actually going to protect our values?
Yeah, that's the big one.
When we look at the future of ethical AI, are we placing our trust in the established big tech companies with their, endless resources and immense scale? Or does the responsibility for building technology we can actually trust rest on the shoulders of tiny, scrappy startups?
It really is the defining tension of the tech industry right now. We're essentially watching a high-stakes battle for the moral architecture of our future, and it's playing out in real time.
And to figure out what is really happening on the front lines of this battle, we have pulled together a totally fascinating stack of sources for you today. We're looking at a recent panel and keynote event.
Hosted by the AI Startup Center and the Digital Society Initiative, right?
Exactly. And we have insights from an incredibly diverse group of thinkers here. We've got the author of a provocative new Manifesto of Smallness, a UN AI ethics strategist, plus this whole collection of tech lawyers, philosophers, and founders who are actually building these systems from the ground up.
It's a rare opportunity, honestly, to hear theoretical philosophy crash directly into the hard commercial realities of building a business. Usually, those two worlds are kept in completely separate silos.
They really are. Which makes our mission for today's deep dive perfectly clear. We want to cut through the massive volume of corporate jargon. We want to figure out if startups truly are morally superior, why so many established companies are just completely failing at AI ethics, despite having all the tools they need to succeed, and what it actually takes to build ethical technology in the real world.
It's a lot of ground to cover.
Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start with this bold claim from the founder of the AI Startup Center. He published what he calls a Startup Center Manifesto, and his core argument is wild. He says startups are inherently morally superior to any other size of organization.
Yeah, he really doesn't hold back.
Now, I have to admit, that feels like an incredibly huge flex. I mean, are we really supposed to believe that just having fewer employees magically makes a company more ethical?
It's a provocative claim to make, for sure. But he doesn't just throw that concept out there blindly. He builds it on a very specific philosophical foundation, what he terms the philosophy of smallness.
Right.
He breaks this down into four specific pillars to explain why the structural nature of a startup basically forces a higher ethical standard.
I want to walk through those pillars because they really reframe how you look at the tech ecosystem. The first one he brings up is all about customer proximity, and he references the economist Joseph Schumpeter here.
Yes, and for a quick bit of context for you listening, Joseph Schumpeter is the economist famous for the idea of creative destruction.
The theory that economic progress is driven by entrepreneurs constantly innovating and dismantling the old ways of doing things, right?
Exactly. And applying that lens to the tech industry, the manifesto argues that startups have to build direct, face-to-face relationships with their customers simply to survive. They literally know their early adopters by name.
Whereas large organizations, by contrast, only know their customers by hearsay or through layers of detached data, big tech employees are generally looking up at their managers and their internal KPIs.
Their key performance indicators.
Right. Basically, the corporate scorecards that determine their bonuses, they're looking at those rather than looking out at the actual human beings using the product.
So the idea is that proximity creates an immediate feedback loop for moral and societal needs. You cannot easily ignore the ethical concerns of someone you are looking directly in the eye or someone you just got off a 50-minute Zoom call with.
That makes a lot of sense, which leads to the second pillar: less power, less corruption. Startups are, by definition, small. We're all familiar with the old adage that absolute power corrupts absolutely.
And the author points out this is a remarkably accurate description of today's big tech monopolies. Because startups lack that sheer encompassing power, they literally lack the capacity to cause societal harm on a global scale.
But doesn't that just mean they are too small to do damage rather than actually being morally superior?
Well, the author frames it as structural damage control. Even an unethical startup can only cause a limited blast radius before it runs out of funding or fails. A poor ethical decision at a tech giant, however, impacts billions of people instantly. The overarching argument here is that decentralization of power is the fundamental key to a healthy society.
Which brings us to the third pillar, shared values. The manifesto argues that when you have a tiny team, say, 5 people sitting in a cramped co-working space, trust, fairness, and transparency aren't just buzzwords printed on a corporate poster in the break room.
Right. They are daily survival tools. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is where the philosophy of smallness really clicks into place. This suggests that for a startup, ethics isn't a luxury item you add on once you are profitable. It is a structural necessity for keeping the team intact.
You literally can't function without it.
Think about your own workplace or any group project you've been a part of. Isn't it naturally easier to align on a shared purpose and call out bad behavior in a tight-knit group where everyone knows each other's motivations?
Definitely.
The sheer scale of massive corporations dilutes individual moral accountability because you are just one cog in a machine of 5,000 employees spread across 12 different time zones.
That makes intuitive sense to me. But then we hit the fourth pillar, and I have to push back a bit. He calls it long-term perspectives for peace.
This is where it gets a bit lofty.
Yeah. The author argues that innovation inherently requires long-term thinking, and because geopolitical tensions and friction force populations into short-term survival mode, the very act of being a startup entrepreneur fighting to innovate is an act of fostering peace and social well-being. I mean, wait, a tech startup building a B2B software tool is fostering global peace? That feels incredibly romanticized, maybe even a little naive.
I see why you would say that, but it stems from a specific economic theory. The argument is that entrepreneurs require stability and long-term horizons to bring complex innovations to market. Because their success depends on a stable, flourishing society, their incentives are naturally aligned with peace and long-term societal well-being rather than short-term extraction.
It is an optimistic view, certainly.
It is, but it paints the entrepreneur as a necessary stabilizing force.
It's a fascinating framework. But if smallness is the ultimate key to ethical alignment, what happens when these companies try to scale? Because the broader AI industry seems to be struggling profoundly to actually implement these ideals. Our source material takes a significant pivot here, bringing in a keynote speaker who is an ethics, policy, and governance strategist at the UN.
And she drops a staggering statistic that completely changes the complexion of this conversation.
Yes. She references a recent survey of business leaders where 87% of them say responsible AI is a high or medium priority for their company. But the number of leaders who actually feel highly prepared to adopt it effectively, just 15%.
That is an enormous implementation gap. 87% have the desire to do the right thing, but only 15% know how to execute it.
And the immediate assumption many people make when hearing that data is that the technology must be too new. We must lack the proper guidelines, the roadmaps, the tools to build ethical AI.
But the keynote speaker reveals that is a complete illusion. She points out that in the year 2023 alone, there were 200 different responsible AI frameworks published globally.
200.
And to help implement those theoretical frameworks, there were over 2,000 different toolkits available.
Mm-hmm.
So it is definitively not a lack of tools holding these companies back.
So if these companies have the toolkits, where's the disconnect happening internally?
What's fascinating here is it actually comes down to the floor plan.
The floor plan.
Yes. What her research team discovered when they went inside Swiss companies to diagnose the problem was that how a company defines the very concept of ethics depends almost entirely on which department is put in charge of it. Where responsible AI lives in the corporate structure dictates exactly what it becomes.
Let's break down the 3 main places it usually ends up, because this is so revealing. First, ethics often gets dumped into legal and compliance.
And if it lives there, it is treated purely as regulatory compliance. Now, the positive side of this structure is that the legal department has teeth. They can step in and slam the brakes on a risky AI system before it launches.
But the negative consequence is substantial. The law is the floor of human behavior, not the ceiling. If an engineering practice isn't strictly illegal, the compliance team often assumes it's ethical. If you equate ethics entirely with avoiding lawsuits, you miss a vast spectrum of moral responsibility.
Exactly. Then you have the second scenario.
Yeah.
Ethics is handed over to the technical and engineering teams. If it sits here, ethics gets translated entirely into technical metrics like fairness matrices and error rates.
The positive is that these teams are close to the actual architecture. They can build constraints and safety rails directly into the code from day one.
But engineers are trained to solve quantifiable problems. Mm-hmm. They have a significant blind spot for anything that cannot be easily measured. If an ethical dilemma is qualitative, if you cannot put a clean number on a concept like human autonomy, dignity, or democratic values, It does not fit into a spreadsheet or a training algorithm.
So those crucial human elements become completely invisible to that department.
Precisely. Which leaves us with the third scenario, creating a dedicated ethics office.
On paper, this sounds like the best solution. You have specialized experts who are independent from the intense pressure to deliver products on a tight deadline.
Unfortunately, the reality is often brutal. These dedicated offices almost always lack any real structural authority. Their role is purely advisory. Even worse, creating a separate ethics team gives every other department in the company a convenient excuse to abdicate their own responsibility.
It creates a siloed culture where an engineer can say, oh, the ethical implications of this feature, that's not my job, that's the ethics team's job down the hall.
Exactly. Big tech treats ethics as a feature to be assigned to a specific desk, rather than a culture that has to be integrated into the whole building.
And the keynote speaker also highlighted a series of very real pain points these companies are hitting. They vastly underestimate the budget and time responsible AI requires. There are constant, unresolved clashes between ethical principles and hard business goals. Plus, there is a pervasive wait-and-see attitude right now.
Driven heavily by regulatory uncertainty.
Right. The companies interviewed expressed profound frustration with regulations, specifically pointing to things like the EU AI Act as being too vague and lacking sector-specific guidance. And just to be clear to you listening, we aren't taking a political stance on those regulations or the EU AI Act itself. We are simply reporting the reality on the ground. The uncertainty around these rules is causing companies to freeze and do nothing rather than take action.
Which is precisely why the keynote speaker proposed a completely different diagnostic approach. Instead of handing a company the 201st theoretical framework and lecturing them on what they should do, her team developed a system called the TACO approach.
TACO, tangibility and control.
You got it. It maps out a company's specific pain points based on those two dimensions. First, how tangible or measurable is the problem? And second, how much internal control does the company actually have to fix it versus being at the mercy of external market forces?
Can you walk us through what that actually looks like in practice?
Certainly. Imagine a mid-sized health tech firm struggling with biased data in their diagnostic AI. Instead of reading a generic 50-page ethics white paper, they plug their specific organizational constraints into the TACO diagnostic system. The ultimate goal of this project is to use AI itself specifically, train chatbots and real-time dashboards to help that firm build a customized, highly specific ethical roadmap.
So the dashboard might tell them, based on your limited engineering budget and high regulatory control, your first step isn't to rebuild the algorithm from scratch, but to implement this specific human-in-the-loop review process.
Exactly. It moves the industry from prescribing generic rules to enabling custom, practical solutions.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Just when you think we have a solid grasp on how startups operate and how established companies can fix their structural flaws, our source material shifts to a vibrant panel discussion. And this panel of tech lawyers, founders, and philosophers completely pushes back on that original startup manifesto.
Oh, they definitely brought some heavy skepticism to the idea that smallness automatically equals moral superiority. The debate was incredibly sharp. They started by dismantling that very first pillar of the manifesto. Customer proximity.
Yes. And to explain this, the tech lawyer on the panel brings up the animated movie Ratatouille.
It's a brilliant comparison.
She compares the early stage startup customer to Anton Ego, the terrifying, powerful food critic from the film. Anton Ego has the absolute power to make or break a restaurant with a single review. The lawyer argues that customers hold this exact same ego power over a new startup. If you are a giant corporation like Coca-Cola or Netflix, you can absorb a wave of bad press.
But if you are a tiny startup, a single bad Trustpilot review accusing you of shady data practices can completely destroy your credibility and end your business overnight. The argument is that the market forces you to be ethical.
It is a highly compelling analogy. You are literally at the mercy of your users' feedback.
But the panel quickly points out the critical flaw in relying on that dynamic. Listening to your customer does not guarantee an ethical product, because we have to recognize the severe limits of customer morality.
And the panel brings up fast fashion as the perfect counterexample to customer proximity. Fast fashion companies are incredibly close to their customers. They track exactly what people want to wear, they listen intently to pricing demands, and they deliver precisely what the market is asking for at breakneck speed.
But behind the scenes, those same companies are notoriously unethical regarding environmental devastation and horrific labor conditions.
This touches on a classic distinction in philosophy and economics. Markets are exceptionally good at capturing customer preferences, meaning what people are actually willing to pay for in the moment.
Right. But markets are terrible at capturing customer values, what people genuinely believe they should do. If a startup is only optimizing for customer preferences, they might build a highly successful, immensely profitable, and completely unethical product simply because that is what the crowd wants.
And even if you, as an individual customer, have incredibly strong moral values, you might not be able to act on them. The panel brought up the concept of contextual lock-in, using WhatsApp as a prime example. You might deeply value privacy. You might morally want to delete WhatsApp from your phone and only use a secure, encrypted app like Signal.
But your entire family, your professional network, and your kids' school communication group are all trapped on WhatsApp.
Exactly. The psychological and social friction of trying to leave is immense. Imagine trying to convince your kid's soccer coach and all the other parents to download a new app just because the old one has dubious data practices. You risk losing vital social capital and connection. You are trapped in the network effect.
So you cannot just assume the free market will organically punish bad actors and reward ethical startups if the customers themselves are locked into the ecosystem.
But the harshest reality check in the panel came when they discussed the inevitable clash between capitalism and ethics. The tech lawyer pointed out that a startup's ethical motivation might only last until they actually achieve a reasonable level of success.
Because once you are scaling up, once your VP of finance has to sit down and give quarterly revenue updates to venture capital investors, ethical AI falls straight to the bottom of the priority list.
The commercial objectives of a scale-up, rapid growth, market capture, delivering outsized investor returns are not inherently dependent on how ethical your product is.
In fact, ethics often introduce friction that slows down growth. And when you look at the established big tech giants, they often operate on what the panel called relative ethics.
That led to my absolute favorite quote from this entire deep dive. The lawyer was criticizing how big AI companies eagerly sign onto these voluntary safety pledges and industry codes of conduct, but they always qualify their behavior as being relative to the rest of the industry. She summarized their attitude by saying, "In a class full of murderers, I'm a real thief."
It perfectly captures the absurdity of corporate ethics grading on a curve. If the baseline standard set by the tech giants is incredibly low, simply being slightly better than the absolute worst offender in the market does not magically make your product trustworthy or ethical.
We do want to make sure we are looking at all sides of this debate, though. The philosopher on the panel stepped in to defend the startup ecosystem, and he relied on the economic philosophy of Friedrich Hayek to do it.
For those unfamiliar, Hayek's theories heavily emphasize the idea of decentralized knowledge. He argued that top-down, centralized planning usually fails because no single entity can possess all the necessary information to solve complex problems.
And applied to AI, Hayek's defense isn't about the individual moral purity of one startup founder. It is about the power of a decentralized ecosystem.
Right. If you rely on a massive, rigid corporation, they dictate a one-size-fits-all solution from the top down. But if you have a chaotic, decentralized ecosystem of thousands of smaller agent startups experimenting with radically different models, that system will organically find the best moral fit for local communities through trial and error.
Because whatever the local community completely rejects gets naturally kicked out of the market. And unlike a corporate middle manager who is solely motivated by hitting a quarterly profit target, startup founders have the agility to be motivated by personal realization. They can be driven by ideological models or by a burning desire to solve a specific bias or problem they care deeply about.
They aren't entirely bound to the immediate demands of shareholder profits in those early days. And even if an individual ethical startup fails, which many do, the ecosystem as a whole acts as an evolutionary engine for finding better, more ethical ways to live and operate.
So what does this all mean? As the panel wrapped up their discussion, they touched on a truly powerful idea that bridges this entire debate. Startups might lack what they called institutional persistence, meaning they fail frequently, or they eventually get bought up and absorbed by the very big tech giants they set out to disrupt.
But the actual act of creating an ethical startup in the first place is an act of rebellion.
It is about forcefully setting a new standard. Think about the early innovations in vehicle safety. The very first companies to pioneer putting seatbelts or airbags in cars might not have all survived as independent legacy brands, but their disruption forced a societal recalibration.
They proved the safety technology could be built, and eventually the public demanded that it become the baseline legal standard for every single car on the road. AI startups pushing the boundaries of responsible tech are serving as those early safety disruptors for the digital age.
Right now, we operate completely backward. We develop incredible, powerful, society-altering technology first, release it into the wild at scale, and then sit around waiting for ethics, regulation, and the community to scramble and adapt to the collateral damage.
And the shared goal of everyone we heard from today, from the manifesto author to the UN strategist to the panel debaters, is to flip that script entirely. We need to bring ethics ahead of the technology and prove that ethical AI can actually be a highly profitable competitive advantage.
Which requires a profound shift, not just from the engineers and founders building the tools, but from the consumers buying and using them. Which brings us to a final provocative thought I want to leave you with. During her keynote, the UN strategist briefly mentioned in passing that algorithms don't come with an easy-to-understand food label, and I haven't been able to stop thinking about that concept.
It's a great visual.
Consider this for a moment. Imagine if tomorrow morning, every single app, social feed, and AI tool on your phone was legally required to display a moral nutrition label before you could open it.
Just like scanning the calories, sugar content, and artificial ingredients on the back of a box of cereal at the grocery store.
Exactly that. Imagine opening your favorite productivity app or social media platform and seeing a clear, standardized label tracking the ethical origins of its training data. Imagine a dial showing its specific risks for algorithmic bias, or a grade evaluating the labor practices and wages of the human workers across the globe who annotated that data. If you could plainly and immediately see the true ethical cost of a piece of software before you clicked agree, would it actually change your daily digital diet?
This raises an important question about human behavior. Or when you are stressed, rushing to finish a project, and hungry for digital convenience, would you just swipe past and ignore the label anyway, much in the same way we sometimes ignore the high sugar content in a donut because it tastes good in the moment?
It's the ultimate question we have to face. We spend so much of our time debating whether big tech monopolies or scrappy startups are morally superior, but are our own consumer habits or relentless preference for cheap, fast, and easy, over what is fundamentally actually the ultimate bottleneck to an ethical AI future. Something for you to chew on until next time. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We will see you on the next one.